history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. Maybe they're down the street, maybe right next door, or maybe they gather every week at a restaurant like the Old Bold Pilots in Oceanside, California. We're going to meet a couple of these nonagenarian aviators today. The idea is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn things we really can't learn anywhere else. We're educated, entertained, and often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Now, you're going to hear the hustle and bustle of a busy restaurant today because this show is recorded at Denny's on the corner of Vista and El Camino Real in Oceanside, California, where every Wednesday morning at 7 a.m., a group called the Old Bold Pilots holds court. You'll know you found the right spot when you notice the models of the warbirds they flew decades ago hanging from the ceiling. First, we're going to hear from 94-year-old Rod Braswell, who completed 50 missions as a B-24 pilot during World War II. So when it comes to the Old Bold Pilots getting together at Denny's in Oceanside every week, do you guys ever have a contest to see who's the oldest, boldest?
We celebrate the oldest pilot here whenever we have a Christmas party, and that pilot gets to cut the cake and be served first. And that's the only time we ever do anything on who is the oldest.
And you probably have to wait a while to claim that title, huh?
Oh, yeah. There's about, I think, probably four people that are older than me. I'll be 95 this year. But we have several pilots here that their birthdays occur a few months before mine, so they'll turn 95 shortly before me.
Yeah, you're only 94, one of the young bucks in this group of old, bold pilots. Rod Braswell is telling his story now. You grew up in Virginia, went to high school in Washington, D.C. Let me ask you, as a young boy, I know that's a long time ago, 80 years ago we're talking or more, do you remember what some of your dreams or your ambitions or your ideas about the future were?
You know, when I was in high school, I was more interested in the ladies or the girls there at the high school for me to even know that there was a war approaching. And I graduated in 39 from the high school, and war was pretty hot in Europe at that time and getting hotter. But I didn't even know there was a war going on. I was so interested in the girls.
I guess so, and that probably didn't change at Virginia Tech.
It hasn't changed yet. I've been married three times. I'm 94 years old, and I have a girlfriend that I'm very interested in.
Aha. Uh-huh. So you're thinking about marriage number four?
You know, I talked to her about that, and she said, I said, I'd like to ask you to marry me, but before I do, I have to be assured that you'll say no. And she said, okay. So I asked her to marry me, and she said no.
I can tell this is going to be a fun interview already. So you go off to college at Virginia Tech, and I guess that's where you were on December 7th, 1941.
Actually, I just went 1 year to Virginia Tech, and then my dad was military, and he moved to California. And so I was going to a junior college up in Salinas, Monterey County, mm-hmm. when Pearl Harbor hit.
Okay.
In December of 41.
So that would be at Hartnell? Is that the junior
yes,
college
that
up there?
Is the junior college. It was called Salinas Junior College at the time, but it is Hartnell now.
Well, and I know they're listening there on one of our affiliates, 1460 KION, that airs the show every Saturday at 3.
So really?
They'll appreciate that Salinas reference.
Uh-huh.
So what do you remember about that day in Salinas on December 7th, 1941?
It was a very notable day in as much as that my sister living in Virginia had delivered a baby a couple of 3 days before, and my mother had gone east to be with her daughter at the time. And so I did not have a mother at home. My father was home, of course. We were all wondering, where do we go from here with this big event like Pearl Harbor? My mother talked to my dad about whether she should stay with my sister or come back to be with her family, because there's so much unknown about what's going to happen now. And the decision was made that she would come back to be with her family, because my dad might be transferred somewhere like overnight. And she did come back to stay with her family. On December 7th, it was about December 9th, I think, when she came back.
So, I mean, it sounds like your world was a little tumultuous at that point.
Very much so. I didn't know where I was going to be going from there either. At the time, I did have a pilot's license that the government sponsored a program for teaching people who were in college how to fly single-engine small airplanes. And I did have a private license at that time. And I thought, well, with the war heating up like it is, I guess I'm going to be in the Army Air Corps. And so that's where I went when I finished my 2 years of college.
Where did that flying bug start for you? How young were you when you thought, you know, I would love to fly?
Actually, it started before I got my license, because I was working with a fellow who had a private license. And I lived in Monterey County. And he said he knew some girls down in Los Angeles, and he was going to go down there to see them. Would I like to go? And I'd never been to Los Angeles in my life, so I said, okay, let's go. And while we were here, we went out to a little airport that's not there anymore, but it's in East Los Angeles, and he rented a small airplane and took me up, and he did a snap roll, and he did a couple of spins, and when we got on the ground, he said, how'd you like that? And I said, I like that just fine. And he said, you could be a pilot. And that was the beginning of my flying career.
Wow. Put that thought in your head, and you ran with it.
I certainly did. Yeah, that's what happened.
You enlist in the Army Air Corps with that idea of being a pilot. And just about every Army Air Corps veteran I talked to, that's what he wanted to be, was a pilot. But a lot of them didn't end up as pilots. They're navigators, bombardiers, gunners. Were there some times where you wondered if you were cut out for this, if you were going to make it into that pilot seat?
Well, I really didn't have much doubts on the basis that I knew how to fly before I got into the Army Air Corps.
Mm-hmm.
And so I felt confident enough that I will make it all the way through. And I did, of course.
Were you thinking multi-engine, or were you one of those guys who said, man, I want to fly one of those fighters?
I didn't want fighters. I wanted a twin-engine airplane called an A-20.
Mm.
And that's a smaller airplane with a crew of three or four.
Yeah.
The pilot does fire the guns. There's a bombardier and a gunner. There's a turret in the top. And they don't fly very high, a small crew, and they don't fly for hours. But that's not what they gave me. They gave me the four-engine bomber that flies high. It's cold up there, and along with a whole bunch of other things, and a big crew that I'm responsible for. And at 22 years old, that's a lot of responsibility for a kid my age.
Yeah, no doubt, especially for 50 missions over Europe during World War II and B-24s for the 456th Bomb Group. What do you remember about mission numero uno, the first time that you went up, as you said, with all that responsibility and all these men under your care?
Well, the first time I went on a mission, I kind of rode along with another crew because they were trying to get me acquainted with combat easy. And I had flown in the local area for training missions, and now I'm ready for my first mission. So I'm flying with a strange crew. And interesting enough, the target was an airport in Rome. And I still don't know why that I never saw an enemy plane. I never saw a burst of black. So there was no enemy opposition at all, even though I was really scared. It probably was the most scared I've ever been because of the unknown. I didn't know what to expect, and with the unknown factor, I just was really scared. And I had occasions to be scared after that where I wasn't so scared. But that was interesting that with no enemy action, that I was afraid like that.
That makes me wonder, as uneventful as that first mission was, that didn't give you a false sense of confidence, did you?
No, I talked to people and told me that that was very unusual. The people in my group that had flown before me, because I was a replacement crew, they had three missions under their belt when I joined their group, and they were telling me stories about how the enemy action was pretty heavy. And so don't think that that's the way it's going to be. Like when you went to Rome, it's going to be much rougher than that.
Where were you flying from?
My base was in Italy, and it was close to a town called Foggia. Foggia is a pretty good-sized city on the Adriatic. It was on the east side of Italy where I was based. So to get to Rome, I would have to fly due west across the country and up across the Mediterranean, and then turn inland to Rome where the target was. That was the first mission. Most missions went east, though, to the Balkans, over to Ploiesti and Romania, and some missions into Vienna and the other countries in that area.
You just said the P word, Ploiesti. It's infamous for bomber pilots and bomber crews during World War II. The first raid there was about as devastating a mission as American bombers flew during World War II, with so many planes shot down. You weren't on the first one, but you were on the second, third, and fourth Ploiesti raids.
Yeah, that's correct. Uh-huh.
And that oil field, the reason it was such a highly defended target was that it was a really important oil field for the German war machine.
Well, they say that more than 50% of their oil came out of Ploesti for Hitler's war machine. And you've heard this saying that when it comes to oil, you don't leave home without it. And we used to call Ploesti Hitler's gas station.
Uh-huh.
He depended on Ploesti so heavily for the fuel.
So when you find out that that's your target, I'm sure you know how many American planes were shot down the first time they went after Ploesti, right?
Yes, I did know.
Was that a little intimidating to find out that's where we're going?
Definitely. In fact, let me tell you that when I speak to a lot of groups, and I do, the question that they ask the most is, well, weren't you scared? And my answer is always, yes, I was scared, but I volunteered for this job, and I have to do the best I can. So I was scared.
So give us a sense of what that was like, what you encountered on those Ploesti missions.
When you don't rate very high on the pecking order, my airplane never was scheduled to fly up close to the front. So as I'm approaching the target with some several hundred airplanes up ahead of me that I can see, and I can see all that flak coming from the ground and bursting in the air where the sky is almost black from those shells breaking, and I know that my turn to go through that is coming. Not there yet, but my turn is coming to go through what I can see up there. And that's pretty much devastating to see that kind of a situation that you have to look forward to.
You're seeing the black puffs of smoke, and then you're seeing the planes getting rattled by it.
Well,
and damaged, right?
Damaged and falling out of the sky. Mm-hmm. I watched my buddies fall out of the sky when it was my turn to go through that flak like that.
So
and I always got hit every time I'd go, so you never knew.
Can you give us a sense of what that feels like? I mean, and it's you and a 10-man crew?
Yes, 10-man. Well, we're flying high at 25,000 feet, and it's probably about 35 degrees below zero. We have to wear oxygen masks at that altitude. And the condensation from the breathing is freezing around your neck and forming ice. I have a flak suit, which amounts to a cloth suit with the metal in the front to protect you from the shells, but nothing in the back because the pilots have armor plate in back of them. So with the heavy weight from the metal tugging on the front and nothing in the back of this canvas suit, that it's cutting your neck where the suit cuts is joined at the top. Your neck is being cut by that suit. You got ice on your neck. It's 35 below, and you got a helmet that was given to the doughboys up in the front lines that does not provide for earphones, and I have to wear that helmet to protect me, and my ears are being crushed, I'm cold, and I'm being shot at.
Sounds like a picnic.
Yeah.
What do you do in those moments? Do you close your eyes and clench your teeth? What do you do?
Well, at 22, you don't do things like that. You just think that this is not your turn, you hope anyway. And do the job that you volunteered for.
So those Ploesti missions, obviously a heavily defended target. You're getting shot up by flak every single time. In all 50 of your missions, how frequent would you say that flak was? Was it an ever-present danger and threat to you?
Well, I told you we didn't see any flak on the first mission into Rome, but the rest of them all had flak everywhere I went after that. There was damage to my plane. Some shells would break below the plane and push my airplane up in the air, and sometimes they would go right through the plane without exploding and explode above the plane. So you just never knew what was going to happen with that flak. And every time I went, I had damage to the plane. And when they patched the holes in the plane, sometimes the holes weren't much bigger than a baseball. And when they patched them, they would use the unpainted aluminum, bright colored aluminum. And my plane was OD colored, the OD paint. My
That's olive drab, OD. Right?
Yeah, olive drab.
Uh-huh.
And so my plane was really ugly with all those patches on it. It had so many patches on it, it almost looked like silver instead of the olive drab color.
As long as it brings you home, right?
Yeah. Well, it didn't always do that. I went through three airplanes. One time I was over France, coming home from France, coming south off the target. When I hit the coast, I only had two engines on one side that would work. That means I'm not going to make it back to base. So it's decision time. The planes cannot hold altitude at level flight, so we're going down at all times, meaning you need to make a decision. And the navigator said that our choices are to set down in the water, which is not a very good choice. Another one is to land in Switzerland, which is neutral, and you would be interned for the rest of the war to never fly or fight again. And the third choice would be to go into Corsica, where we have a B-25 field. And if you go into Corsica, you will live to fight again. And I polled the crew. I asked everyone on the crew, which way do you want to go? I got only one answer from 10 different men. Let's go to Corsica so we can live to fly and fight again. And I thought that's one of the reasons we're called the greatest generation is because of 10 men want to fly and fight again.
Well said. But easier said than done, landing a crippled B-24 on Corsica. You said you only had two engines working. That's only half of what you're used to.
Let me tell you that when you have two engines out on one side, it takes two pilots to stand on one rudder to keep it straight. So you've got to coordinate as you're coming in on the approach to land to back off together on that one rudder to keep the plane straight. So it's not easy to land a plane with two engines out on one side. Very difficult.
So how did that landing materialize?
Well, I'm surprised how well it went. I had no idea it was going to go that well. So there's no way to taxi after you get on the ground with two engines out on one side. So it was a matter of just parking the airplane down at the end of the runway and let them pull it off the runway. And I was picked up. The crew was picked up that night so that we could fly again.
And he would fly again and again. Time for our first break now. But when we come back, more from Rod Braswell's 50 missions as a B-24 pilot, including the time a shell exploded right in the nose of his bomber. We're also going to meet the Flying Greek, a fighter pilot who became a double ace in the skies over Europe. Find photos of both of our guests at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook, and we'll be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country, and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, hanging out with the old bold pilots in Oceanside, California. Big thanks to Captain Mac McNichol, for introducing me to some of his friends in this large group, which has been written up in Smithsonian and all kinds of different media outlets. Every Wednesday morning in Oceanside, they meet for breakfast and war stories at Denny's Restaurant. And we'll continue now with 94-year-old Rod Braswell, who piloted B-24 Liberators for 50 missions in Europe during World War II, including one in which an anti-aircraft shell exploded right in the nose of the plane.
When the shell came through the nose, it took about half the butt off the nose gunner's body. He had to be pulled out of there and given morphine for the pain, but he lived all the way through the mission. Then we had a navigator that lost an eye because of the explosion coming through the nose. But what I want to tell you was that when pieces of the airplane are coming back across the windshield, you have to think this thing can't stay together much longer, so you better get out of formation before it blows up and takes other planes with it. If I'm going to blow up, I don't want to take some other planes with me. So I pulled out of formation in case I had to go down, getting ready to climb out of the seat to parachute when I realized that the plane is still flying. I got back in the seat, got back in formation, and took the plane into a field close to Foggia, where they have a full hospital. Our base did not have a hospital. They just had a clinic with a doctor. We need a hospital now. So I put that plane down in Foggia and never saw it again.
And you would have never seen him again if you didn't get him to a hospital, probably.
He died that night. The guy that lost his eye from the explosion, he lived, of course, but he didn't fly again with only one eye.
What about you personally? You ever have some of that shrapnel get a piece of you?
Well, the closest I ever came to being damaged by shrapnel, a piece hit me on my flak suit with the metal in it, and the energy was probably pretty well spent to where the piece of flak, which is probably 4 inches long, fell to the floor of the airplane, and it did not break the skin, so I don't have a Purple Heart.
And I don't hear you complaining about that.
No, I'm not complaining. I kept that piece of flak, and I've got it mounted on the wall at my home today.
What do you think of when you look at that?
I think of those were days that I'd like to forget.
Well, I appreciate you going back there with us and helping us understand what it was like. You don't have a Purple Heart, but you do have the Distinguished Flying Cross. What was the mission that resulted in that?
The B-24 has wingtip tanks for gasoline, for extra gas, but that was a late modification to the airplane, so they did not have any fuel lines from the wingtip tanks right into the engines. You had to transfer the fuel from the wingtips into the main tanks. The transfer pump had taken a shell on another mission, and so the pump didn't work. And so when we tried to make it work, it was spewing gas all over the bomb bay. The engineer said that I should shut the pump off because I'm the one with the switch where it could turn it on and off. So I turned the pump off, and I called the Navy to pick me up in the Adriatic because I would not make it back to base. And they asked for a long call and how much longer I'd be in the air and so forth. So they had me spotted, and they're going to pick me up out of the Adriatic. And they told me I wouldn't be in the water over 5 minutes. Well, the B-24 doesn't float that long, so that's not something to look forward to, really. So 30 minutes or so later, the engineer comes up, and he says, let's try that pump again. And I said, why? He said, it might work. So I flipped the switch on the pump, and he says, it's working. And I said, how come it's working? He told me that he had found some rags and some wire in the back of the plane, and he had patched it up to make it work. And I should tell you that this engineer is a country boy used to fixing tractors on the farm rather than go to town and buy the parts. He's used to fixing them there, so he knew how to fix that pump and make it work one more time. And I called the Navy and told him, don't look for me in the Adriatic. I'm going home. Got the plane all the way back to base.
Did you write him up for a commendation for that?
I did, but I don't know what happened to it. I don't know.
Do you think you'd be sitting here talking to me right now if he didn't have that farm boy ingenuity?
Absolutely not. In fact, it's interesting that you said that because my first engineer was 31 years old, and I took him down on the Adriatic one time for them to have some fun and just shoot up the duck blinds because they don't get to strafe when they're 5 miles high. And when I got back on the ground, he told me, the 31-year-old engineer said he was going to quit flying with me or any of the other kids on the basis that we're too young and too risky. And I said, well, what's your problem? He said, when you were diving on the water next to those duck blinds for us to shoot at, and when you pulled up, you got water in the back end of the airplane. He said, I don't want to fly with you guys anymore. And so I got the country boy to be my engineer. That's the reason I think I'm here today.
How about that?
Yeah, isn't that a great story?
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Pretty incredible.
Just fate. I must have had a guardian angel looking over me because too many times I should have not be here. I should have gone down in Italy somewhere. Too many times.
I imagine when you come to the Old Bold Pilots here every Wednesday morning, you probably hear about a lot of guardian angels.
Oh, definitely. All these people, well, they're not all combat pilots, but they've all got stories, and you hear different stories from different people, of course, and it's good to listen to other people's stories besides your own. So I try to listen to the other guys.
When it comes to your story, what are you most thankful for and what are you most proud of?
Well, I'm most thankful that I had the switch of engineers because that country boy did save my life by getting that pump fixed up. Most proud of that I was able to complete 50 missions and that I'm 94 years old because I think there are not too many people that are in that boat.
I think that's a very small boat, but one that's going to keep floating for quite a while.
Yeah.
I want to thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us in such descriptive fashion how you feel about it. One more question. You, many years ago, were able to participate in a program that thankfully thousands and thousands of veterans across America have experienced, the Honor Flight Program, taking you to Washington, D.C. to see the National World War II Memorial.
Right.
What was that experience like for you? What did you get out of being there at this memorial to what you referenced, Your Greatest Generation?
The World War II Memorial was the main attraction for us to go back on the honor flight. I had contributed some money towards the construction of that memorial some years earlier.
And a lot of other World War II veterans, and I want to underscore that, $190 million of private donations built that World War II memorial. It wasn't a government project.
That's right. And so my little donation helped build it, and so I was kind of proud of that. And now when the opportunity to go back and take a look at the memorial that represented World War II, along with my donations, of course, I was very pleased to have that happen to me. And when I went, the trip was organized out of Chicago, so we only had three veterans and three guardians. And my son was my guardian. One of the finest things I've ever done in my life was to make that trip, even though it was a very hurried trip. It was certainly a very memorial trip and one that will stick in my mind forever because of so many good things that happened. We joined up with a whole bunch of veterans once we got to Washington from other parts of the country and then toured in a bus, of course, over to the different memorials. But to see the World War II memorial was just something that you didn't want to leave. You just want to stay there and look at that forever.
And when you stood there by the fountain and looked at that wall of all the gold stars signifying 406,000 Americans who didn't come home.
Right.
What came to mind for you?
They're the ones that need to be honored rather than people like myself because they gave it all. And I wanted to divert just a little bit to tell you that I did go back to Italy to see the old airfield in 1992. And the airfield is no longer there. It's a vegetable garden today. But we did go back to where the old airfield was. And then we also went to Milan, the military, American military cemetery there. And I found the name of my bombardier who was killed in another crew. He got transferred to another crew when I went home because I had more missions than he did. But he was on another crew when he was killed. And I did find his name on the wall in Milan.
And I get the underlying sense as you share that, that you're fully aware that easily could have been you.
Absolutely. In fact, that's a wonder that it wasn't, because when I came back on the ship from after 50 missions, I couldn't find another pilot on that ship. I didn't talk to everybody, but I tried to find another pilot, and I couldn't find another one that had flown 50 missions.
Did it mean something to you to get back to America again?
Well, it was a miracle. And like I told you, I think I had a guardian angel because so many people did not come back, and I was one that did.
And I trust I can speak for all of you at home as well when I say we are so glad he did. Rod Braswell, 94 years old. He said he's not the oldest of the old, bold pilots. And here's one who's got him beat by a couple years, 96-year-old Steve Pisanos. I've interviewed hundreds of veterans and tons of pilots, but I don't think I've met somebody who was born in Greece, flew for the British and the Americans, and has a double ace. You're probably the only one that fits all those boxes, right?
Probably, yeah.
Your book is The Flying Greek, but take me back to the beginning. Growing up
in Athens, Greece,
uh-huh.
I fell in love with the Western cowboys. Mm-hmm. I used to go to the movies and see nothing but cowboys. Tom Mix, Buck Jones, Ken Maynard. I wanted to really immediately go to America, but I had no way, no money. I couldn't speak English. So one of my friends, whose son had been with the Greek merchant marine. He says, you join the merchant marine, and someday, Greek ship, you know, is bound to dock in an American port. That's where you just get away from the ship and stay in America. In America, you can do the impossible.
So is that how it happened?
Yeah. So I got a job on a merchant ship, and we went down to South America, then we came back to Greece, and then we went out again, and we came to Baltimore, Maryland. And it was then when I jumped ship. And
how old were you?
I was about 19, 20.
You're 19, 20 years old.
Yeah.
Your family's all back in Greece.
All in Greece, yeah.
Did they know you were plotting this?
Oh, no. They had no idea.
You just jumped ship? With nothing. I mean, you've got nothing,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely, yeah. But one of the guys on the ship there, you know, he says, you don't want to become a merchant marine slave. He said, once we get to Baltimore, he said, get away and go to New York. Mm-hmm. You're bound to find some Greeks there. You know, they got a lot of restaurants and so on. And that's exactly what I did.
Could you speak English yet or no?
Not at all. Not at all.
So
few words.
You jump off a ship in Baltimore. You've got really nothing going for you. No money, no clothes, nothing.
Correct. I had about $5 with me.
And you can't even speak the language.
Exactly.
What in the world were you thinking?
So anyway, I got to New York there and I began to walk. I came out on 34th Street and 8th Avenue. Then I looked across the avenue there and I saw the Greek and the American flag. Oh my God, I said, the Greek flag there. Something. There must be some Greeks. So I crossed the avenue, and it was at a movie house playing The Shepherd's Daughter, the first movie ever made in Greece. Oh, my God, I've seen that in Athens, and all of a sudden, two Greek fellows, you know, stopped behind me, and one of them in Greek. saying in Greek, you know, he says, what do the Greeks know about making movies? Movies are made in Hollywood. So the other guy said, let's go in and see it. And, you know, if we don't like it, we can always walk out. Then it was then when I intervened and I said, excuse me. I said, what is it you want to know about this movie? You know, I saw this movie in Athens. In Athens? And what are you doing here? I told him what I had done. And he said, where are you going? I don't know. I said, I hope, you know, I find it to park and sleep for the night until I find... No, he says, you know, this is my brother. They introduce themselves. He says, you come with us. We live in Brooklyn. And that's how I really saved my leg coming to America.
That's an incredible story in its own right. And you talk about Hollywood and the movies. And I hope your story ends up on the big screen someday. Yeah. I know the book, The Flying Greek, has made many people contemplate that. And Telly Savalas was going to work on that
for
you?
Oh, yeah, Telly. Here he says, we got to make a movie. And, of course, you know, the guy passed away. But Tom Hanks has a copy of the book also, too. Uh-huh. And I met Tom Hanks, you know. He says, my God, he says, what a story.
You think he could play you?
It's hard to tell.
I don't know if anyone would believe this story, though. That's the hard part.
Yeah.
So how do you go from that, without a place to stay in New York, randomly meeting people after you see the Greek flag, to becoming a fighter pilot in World War II?
Once I got established, I got a job on a restaurant. I stayed with these people there for a while. I moved, and I was close to a working place. And then one of my friends there on our day off, he says, you want to really learn how to fly? I said, yeah, I'd like to. But he says, let's go down to Floyd Bennett Field. I'll show you. He took me to Floyd Bennett Field. He introduced me to a guy up there who had two small airplanes, and that's how I began to learn to fly. About a couple of years later, I had accumulated close to 100 hours. I got my private pilot's license. I was able to really learn English and pass the exam. It was then about the war in Europe, of course, had begun, and when one of my friends, you know, I said, all the Italians, you know, invaded Greece, and God done it, if I can really get there. He said, you really want to get to the fight? I said, yeah, but I tried to join the army. They wouldn't take me because I was not an American. He said, how would you like to join the Royal Air Force? I said, what? He said, the Royal Air Force is here in America and recruiting American pilots. You have a license? He says, I tell you, he says, you go to the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York City. On the third floor, there is an office, Clayton Knight Committee. Walk in and tell them who you are, show the license, and tell them what you want to do. On my day off, I caught the train. I went to New York and found the hotel. And I walked into this office, you know, and I introduced myself. And they took my name and everything. He says, we'll notify you. About a month or so later, I got a telephone call. He said, you have been accepted to join the Royal Air Force. And he said, we have made arrangements for you to attend Polaris Flight Academy in Glendale, California. But I had a problem. I was working at the Park Hotel at this time in Plainfield, New Jersey. How do I tell my Park Hotel owner, German fellow, who had come to Germany the same way I did, and he had really become a millionaire? How do I tell him, you know, that I'm going to leave the hotel because I had joined the Royal Air Force? And one day I said to myself, I got to do it. I got to tell him. So I walked into his office and I said, Mr. Stender, I got to tell you something. Well, what is it, Steve? He said, you want another pay? He had given me a couple pay raises. No. I said, Mr. Stender, I told him, you know, what I had done. I thought he was going to get up and punch me in the face. He got up and he came around and, you know, put his hand around my shoulder, you know, and said, Steve, he says, I admire you for what you have done. He said, and I wish you good luck. And all the time I was overseas with the RAF, you know, he sent me packages with goodies and everything. And he said, when the war is over, I want you back in the hotel. And, of course, then I drifted because I decided to stay at the Air Force and so on.
Well, you talk about care packages from him. I'm curious about your family. Did you ever have contact with your family, and how did they react to what you had done?
After the war.
But this whole time during the war, nothing?
I couldn't really get in touch with them.
So they don't know what's happened to you. You
exactly.
took a ship and they never saw you again.
Exactly.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
We'll come back around to that. So you come out here to California to train, and this is before Pearl Harbor, right?
Yeah, correct, yeah.
Because America's not in the war, but
exactly.
the British are,
yeah.
and you want to fly for somebody because your homeland's been invaded.
Correct.
So you become a fighter pilot with the RAF. What did you fly with the Royal Air Force?
I started to fly Hurricanes, and then I switched over to Spitfires.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, well, I was with the 71 Eagle Squadron. Later on, you know, when America came in, the American Eagle squadrons were transferred to the 4th Fighter Group.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, the 4th Fighter Group ended up the war with 1,016 victories.
Ooh.
Unbelievable. Number one outfit in the U.S. Air Force.
And Steve's contributions to that were quite significant. When we come back, we'll hear about a mission you'll have a hard time believing he survived. Find the link to his book, The Flying Greek, at hometownheroesradio.com. And we'll be right back after this. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's RV country within driving distance of this radio station. But really, it doesn't matter where you live, because Paul Everett has a fly and buy program that will fly you to any of his locations to buy your new RV. It's one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Serving RVers for 55 years, you'll find Paul Everett's RV country throughout the West and online at rvcountry.com. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328. Paul Everett's RV Country has 8 locations in 5 western states, including Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, right off the I-5, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. Over 55 years of experience serving the needs of RVers across the country and proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. Find a location near you by visiting rvcountry.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country, with 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a chance to catch up with some of the old bold pilots, a vibrant group that meets weekly in Oceanside, California. If you're ever there on a Wednesday morning, go shake some of their hands at Denny's on the corner of Vista and El Camino Real. You might even meet the Flying Greek, Steve Pisanos, now 96 years old. He left his native land for America as a teenager, became a pilot, and before America even entered World War II, he went to England to fly for the Royal Air Force in the No. 71 Eagle Squadron. Close to 250 volunteers from America ended up flying in those Eagle Squadrons for the RAF. You can read all about Steve's story in his book, The Flying Greek, complete with a foreword written by Walter Cronkite. Let's jump back into that busy restaurant now and ask Steve how many of those Eagle Squadron pilots are still alive in 2016.
Less than a dozen, I would say.
Yeah, and a lot of people have never heard of this. Some people don't even realize that Americans were flying over there before America was in
That's
the war.
That's correct.
So you were flying Spitfires.
Yes.
And what kind of German opposition were you facing?
FW-190s, enemy 109s. I mm-hmm. shot down 10 of them. Mm-hmm. 6 FW-190s and 4 ME-109s. And funny, you know, years later, after the war, I met Adolf Galland,
uh-huh.
a German great guy, you know. And so he was asking me, and you shut down the ME? Oh, I said, yes, General. And wonderful guy, absolutely superb.
10 planes claimed makes you a double ace.
Correct.
But you're over there flying for the Royal Air Force against these German fighters. I imagine you had more than your share of close calls.
Oh, my God, quite a bit, yeah.
What stands out in your mind? If people read your book, what are the ones they're going to say, holy moly, is that the truth?
After 106 missions, I was on an escort mission down to Bordeaux, France, and we got into a fight there. I sat down 3 of the guys there, and of course, on the way back, I lost my engine flying a P-51, and I crash-landed south of Le Havre, about 25, 30 kilometers. The Germans came after me. I was trying to put fire on my crashed Mustang, and they began to fire over my head, all over the place. And I got so scared, I dropped everything and I ran and I got into a forest. They came into the forest, and it was then how I more or less lost them. And for 5 days, I wandered all over the countryside with an injured shoulder. And then about 5 days later, I made contact with the resistance. Thank God I had learned French in high school in Athens. But I never really thought that I would speak French in America, you know. But it came handy, you know, at that time. And I'll never forget one of my Frenchman friends, you know. He told the other guy, he said, "Le Greek American parle français." You know, the Greek American speaks French. And they took care of me so wonderful. And I got decorated by Charles de Gaulle with two kisses when I was given the French Croix de Guerre. And about 3-4 years ago, I got a letter from the American Embassy in Washington. "Dear Colonel Pisanos, the government in Paris discovered that you contributed immensely for our liberation, and they have awarded you the Legion of Honor, the highest French decoration." They wanted to know whether I could go to Washington to be decorated. I told them that I couldn't make it. They came out here and they presented me with the decoration at the museum in San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
And it was unbelievable. There were more people and friends and everybody.
I imagine you received some pretty heady decorations from our government as well.
Oh, yeah.
During the war.
I got 5 DFCs and the Legion of Merit with 2 clusters. And
5 Distinguished Flying Crosses, no big deal. You mentioned that incident. After 106 missions between flying the Spitfires with the RAF and flying American fighters, you're in a P-51, you're shot up, and you brought it in for a crash landing. Did you think about trying to bail out at any point?
Well, I tried to, but I was having difficulties when I decided not to bail out in high altitude because the Germans were really shooting at anybody coming down in a parachute. So I decided to wait until I get lower, but then as I tried to unstrap myself, you know, I was so goddamn close to the ground, and I had stepped out on the from the cockpit, and I was just ready to, you know, when the aircraft was to hit the ground, you know, try to. But thank God, the right wing hit the ground. The aircraft twisted to the right a little bit, and I was thrown way, just missing the prop, the stab prop, you know. And how long I stood right there, you know, lying on my back, and I looked up in the sky, and I said, "My God," I said, "my shoulder," and so on. And it was then when the Germans evidently had spotted me and followed the aircraft, you know, when I crash-landed.
So you weren't even at the controls when you crash-landed.
Oh, yeah.
You were standing.
I was standing outside the cockpit.
Trying to jump.
Yeah. And in fact, you know, my book has the photo on the outside of the book. Mm-hmm. Shows how I'm standing out by the cockpit, outside the cockpit.
Uh-huh. I've seen that photo, and I'll make sure it's on our website at hometownheroesradio.com. So you jump off, you're banged up, you're injured, but the Germans are still shooting at you.
And when I saw the bullets flying all over my head, you know, I decided to drop everything, forget about burning the aircraft, you know, and I began to run. And thank God I was close to the forest there, and that's when I got into the forest. And they came along too, and I lost them in the forest, of course. And for 5 days, I wandered all over the countryside, and I drank water from running creeks, and I found a farm, you know, that had cabbage. And my God, I ate a whole cabbage one day. I was so hungry and scared and injured and so on. And until later on, I made contact with the French.
Right, so this French resistance, the underground, gets you out of there. And then did you go back to flying?
No. When Paris was liberated and some 800 Americans came out from hiding, B-17 guys and fighter pilots, of course, we were all brought back to England, and I went back to my unit, but they wouldn't let me fly. So I was returned to the States, and I was assigned to Dayton, Ohio at Wright Field.
Mm-hmm.
That's when I went through test pilot school with Yeager and Don Gentile and all those guys. And I took a good part in testing the P-80, the first jet we had at Muroc Lake.
I think people are getting the idea from your cross-Atlantic journey that you're plotting and no one else knows about, that you're going to jump off in America to going over to fly for the British, to all these missions for the British and the Americans, to then back as a test pilot. It doesn't seem like you're afraid of much.
No.
Where does that come from?
I don't know. I don't know. The Greek blood or something. something.
The flying Greek. You sure it wasn't the crazy Greek?
Oh, my God. No. Could have been, yeah.
Mentioned that P-80.
Yeah.
What was that like? Because, I mean, this is a complete experiment. Nobody knows if this is safe or not, and it's your job to be the guinea pig.
Yeah,
huh?
I was one of the test pilots who did the test program at P-80. And funny, you know, later on when I met Adolf Galland and I told him I had flown the ME-262, the FW-190, the MU-109, he thought that I was a pilot, you know, belonging to one of the Balkan air forces.
Ah.
So then I had to tell him who I was and so on.
Because that was one of the other things you did at the tail end of World War II was you flew captured enemy aircraft?
Correct. Oh, yeah.
To get a feel for their capabilities?
Yeah, to test it. Yeah, we had them at Wright Field.
Uh-huh.
I flew the FW-190, the ME-109, the Zero, and the ME-262.
So this is after the war's over?
After the war, yeah.
But all these captured aircraft are there. So when you're flying one of these planes that had been flying against Americans during the war, what are you trying to do? What are you trying to learn?
We were trying to find out, you know, what the Germans had done that we did not know.
Mm-hmm.
That's comparing their aircraft with our own aircraft.
So how would you compare the ME-262 to the P-51, which you flew? Because those two saw combat against each other.
Yeah. Well, the ME-262 was, or the FW-190, they were really, the German aircraft were far superior than even the British, the Spitfire or the Hurricane.
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, they were good flying machines.
Does that make it even more amazing to you?
Oh, absolutely.
That your side won?
Absolutely, yeah.
How do you explain all that? How do you explain your story?
Well, it's hard to tell, but... That's why I wrote the book. Yeah.
Did I see somewhere that Jaeger was shot down the same day you were?
The 5th of March, 1944. We didn't know each other, you know, until we met later on, you know. And he said, you went down the 5th of March? I went down, too. And it was the same mission. Our group took the bombers down to Bordeaux, and his group brought the bombers back.
Uh-huh.
And that's when we, both of us, went down.
How about that? And years later, you're test pilots together.
Unbelievable, yeah.
And how long did you keep that up? How long did you continue flying for the Air Force?
I left in the latter part of 44, and I joined TWA.
All right.
I flew for TWA for about a couple more years, and then I was on a flight to Washington, D.C., and I met my buddy, Don Gentile, who was at the Pentagon. And I told him that, you know, I don't know whether the airline flying, you know, is really what I want. Well, he said, about coming back on active duty. I said, they won't take me. I don't have a two-year college. They want college guys. Yeah, but he said, the experience you have, you know, they will ought to have you. I'm going to send you an application for a return to active duty, he said. Oh, about less than a month, you know, a Western Union guy knocked my door. He said, Mr. Pisanos? I said, yeah. He said, you got a telegram. By direction of the President of the United States, you are recalled to active duty and you are to report to headquarters USAF.
So then you went back in, you rose to the rank of colonel?
Yes.
And when did you retire?
The end of 73.
So were you over flying in Vietnam?
Yes, I flew in Vietnam, and I was involved with in Korea, but I didn't fly any missions in Korea. I was delivering fighter aircraft, Mustangs, from the Air National Guard to Korea.
And what did you do in Vietnam?
In Vietnam, I was a pilot with the Caribou Squadron, C-7, and although I had volunteered from Germany to go to Vietnam as a fighter pilot, but when they found out that I had in my records, you know, an airline transport pilot, and they decided to send me, you know, to a Caribou Squadron, and that's where I ended up.
So you're flying cargo planes?
Yeah, I flew over 100 missions in Vietnam.
Do you miss it?
A little bit, yeah. It was a lot of experience, yeah, unbelievable.
You're 96 years old.
Correct.
You don't look it. I don't. Maybe all that time in the air
kept
you young.
You know, one of my friends, you know, wanted to know, what was the secret? I said, olive oil. You drink it? No. I said, I use olive oil in my salads and my cooking and everything, and that's what. So then, funny, you know, about a week or so later, we got together again with a group of guys, and he came along, and I thought you had a bottle of whiskey or something. He opened olive oil. I started to use olive oil. Yeah.
You're passing it on.
Yeah.
If you could tomorrow take any plane up in the sky. And you flew the best planes of every country involved in World War II, and you kept flying long after that. You've flown just about everything. If there's one aircraft you could take up tomorrow, what would it be?
The Mustang.
The P-51.
51, yeah.
Why?
Good aircraft. Well, it had the endurance, was equivalent in maneuvering, equivalent to the Spitfire. And all of us, you know, in the 4th Fighter Group, that we ended up with more victories than any other Air Force organization, felt that the 51 was really the greatest aircraft. Even Adolf Galland admired the 51.
Yeah, he didn't like going up against it, I know.
Yeah.
What do you get out of this group here, the old bold pilots? Why do you come here every week?
Well, the comradeship, you know, meeting the guys, you know, who had been in the Air Force, in the war, and it's just unbelievable, you know, to be associated with guys, you know, who took part in America's dilemma.
You said unbelievable. I think that describes your life story, and I hope people will pick up the book, The Flying Greek. I've got it linked at hometownheroesradio.com. When you think about your own life experience and everything you've been through in 96 years, what's the most amazing part in your mind, the most amazing aspect of your story?
Becoming an American citizen. Honest to God, this wonderful country is the greatest in the world. And I get mad, especially some guys, you know, who one time on the television, he said, "God damn America." Mm. I told my wife, I said, "I'm going to go and meet this guy, you know, and kill that son of a buck, then check in with the FBI. Oh, he says, "Sit down. Don't be silly." But, you know, this country is the most wonderful country on earth. There is no question about that. And anyone who criticizes America or speaks bad about America, I get mad.
Have you ever wondered how different your life would have been if you didn't jump ship in Baltimore?
I would have probably ended up in Greece somewhere and becoming something.
And speaking of Greece, I've got to close that loop here. You said when you left Greece and you came to America, your family didn't hear from you till after World War II. So how did you re-engage with your family, and what was that like?
I finally got in contact with them, and of course they were surprised that I was still alive. But the funny part was that my last assignment in the Air Force, I got a call from the Pentagon. When I came back from Vietnam, I was assigned to Little Rock Air Force Base. I had been promoted to colonel. I got a call, "How would you like to go to Athens as chief of the Air Force mission?" I said, "Come on." I said, "Who are you pulling my leg?" No. He says, this Colonel Hank Stovall, he says, I told my guys to find me a colonel who can speak Greek and fighter pilot and so on. The reason is that the Greek Air Force was looking to buy a new fighter. And they looked at the French Mirage, the British Jaguar, and the American Phantom. And we need someone, you know, who can speak Greek to help us, you know, sell. And my God, that's exactly what happened. They sent me to Athens, you know, and I was the chief of the Air Force mission there. So we had a big competition. So I called a contact I had at the Pentagon. I said, "I want you to make arrangements and send me two Phantoms from Germany for a demonstration in Athens." And that convinced the Greeks, you know, to buy the A4.
Mm-hmm.
And they bought that in 1973-74, and my God, they're still flying it to this day.
Mm-hmm. Thanks to you. A gift to your homeland.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, yes.
Well, Steve, I just want to say thank you for serving our country. Thank you for sharing a little bit of your amazing story with us. Is there anything else you think we need to know?
No, I think America has been the greatest, and you better be good to my adopted country, because if you speak bad about my adopted country, I'll get mad.
Steve's okay. Coming for you.
Okay, my good friend.
Don't mess with that 96-year-old Steve Pizzanos, the Flying Greek. Again, I have a link to his book with that title at our website, hometownheroesradio.com. You'll also find a photo of our other guest today, Rod Braswell. And if you ever find yourself in Oceanside, California on a Wednesday morning, go meet them and the rest of the Old Bold Pilots at Denny's on the corner of Vista and El Camino. We'll hear from another Old Bold Pilot next time when we're reminded once more through the stories of our amazing veterans that freedom is not free.